Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to your podcast, New Books in Economic and Business History. I'm your host, Javier Mejia from Stanford University. And today I have the great pleasure to be with Gary Monk. He's a professor of political science and international relations at the University of Southern California. And he edited this book. It's called Critical Junctures and Historical Legacies, Insights and Methods for Comparative Social Sciences. He edited this book with David Collier. And we're going to be talking today about the book and about Gary's career. How are you, Gary?
Very good. Good to meet you, Javier, and good to be here. I'm looking forward to a nice conversation.
Great. I would like to start hearing more about your life. We were just chatting before, and you were telling me that you are Argentinian. Tell us a bit about how did you end up being a political scientist in the American academic system? How was that whole journey from Buenos Aires to California?
Yes. So we were talking offline in Spanish before we started, sort of, since we both grew up in Latin America. I grew up in Argentina, in Buenos Aires. So I grew up, I did all my schooling, basically primary, secondary. And I actually started university at the University of Buenos Aires in 1976. And I was entering in sociology. This was right after the military coup of March of 1976 that really changed the university life a lot. So I became disenchanted with the university. I didn't finish the first year of university, so I kind of quit, even though I was interested in the topics to read. And this was a tough period in Argentina, the late 1970s. It was a very repressive government. I had to do the military service. I did that for 14 months. Then I was doing odd jobs, basically working as an artisan. So kind of drifting, not having a clear sense of direction, reading all the time. And then with a friend, we came up with the idea of doing a trip, hitchhiking, throughout South America. So we hitchhiked through the north of Argentina, Bolivia, Peru. And then at that point in time, so we wanted to go further north, and then we basically took a plane. I had an uncle that was teaching at Dartmouth in the medical school. He was a chemist that's what his PhD was in. So I went to New Hampshire to visit him. So this is my first exposure to the United States. I arrived in the summer of 1980, and I just liked a lot what I saw as around Dartmouth. And so that made me decide to go back to university. So I hadn't done my BA. So I started to do my BA. I did it at the University of New Hampshire. Then I did an MA at Stanford, where you are, in Latin American Studies. And I did my PhD in political science at the University of California, San Diego. So this wasn't a little bit like how people do it today, that they leave sort of whatever their country is to come to study in the United States. It was a bit much more by accident in that point in time. I really loved academic life here in the United States. So I would have worked hard on my PhD to be able to get a job. And my first job was at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. And then I've been here in Los Angeles at the University of Southern California.
Can I ask you more about that experience in Argentina as a student? Because you mentioned that you were disappointed with the university. Was this because what was happening? Was this influence of the government in the like teaching curriculum, or like what was happening?
Yeah, so the military governments, so the two regimes, starting in the one in 1966 and then the 1976 one, intervened in the university, restricted the autonomy of the university, which was something that was very fundamental in Argentina. Many professors left already sort of with the coup of 1966, so people leaving to the exterior. People as important as Gino Germani, sort of Italian Argentine that essentially founded Argentine sociology, he left, he went to Harvard. Others left at that point in time. And then sort of in what I was studying, sociology was essentially seen as Marxism from the perspective of the military regime. So it was like very restricted. So what had been sort of a university with a lot of discussion, ideas, became very sort of constrained and sort of... So it wasn't what I expected. I was young at that point in time, sort of still learning about sort of the country, sort of ideas. It wasn't something that I particularly liked. So even though I continued to be interested in, I'd always read a lot, sort of, the university life in Argentina at that point in time didn't seem to be for me. The political science was something that, at least in the University of Buenos Aires, came in later, with the return of democracy in 1983. So sort of this is still sort of when you have the development of the social sciences in Argentina at that point in time. You have more the flourishing of different disciplines with the return of democracy in 1983.
And I mean, I don't want to make this entire conversation about Latin America, although that would be fascinating, but now that we're talking about this, I'm curious about your perspective regarding like social science, academia, or education nowadays in Latin America and in Argentina specifically. Because I have the impression that what is happening, at least in economics in recent years, is that there's like a real... like outflow of talents in academia from Argentina. Do you perceive something similar? Are you optimistic about the future of academia in Argentina? I don't know, what's your impression from abroad?
Yes, so I'm actually just working on a book of, I've done several books on like intellectual history. I did one with sort of interviews with people influential in the study of politics, some sociologists in the United States. I'm doing a companion volume with like 10 very influential sociologists, political scientists that really sort of shaped the field in the 60s and 70s. People like Cardoso, then became president of Brazil, Guillermo O'Donnell. It's basically sociologists and political scientists. That was in some sense a golden generation in the 60s, 70s, when Latin America generated and I'd say even exported ideas. And sort of, so these were debated sort of in the United States beyond the Americas. In some sense, sort of, that was a tough period politically, and you had sort of very committed social scientists sort of doing their work. You have a big change. I mean, we really sort of, from the 90s, we enter a very different period. You have the economic crisis in the 80s sort of that really hits universities pretty hard. So that's sort of an important change. I think you have a change then in terms of sort of how people sort of do their research. The most positive trend, I'd say one positive trend, you have lots of people going abroad to study and then returning to their country, some staying outside, really picking up the latest ideas, tools. I think we see this in economics. We see this in probably economics and political science, a bit in sociology, sort of, that people that are sort of being educated abroad in the United States more before, used to be more in Europe, and doing very fine research, publishing partly in Spanish, in Brazil, in Portuguese, partly in English. What I'd say sort of, there's still issues having to do with resources in the university. So I was just visiting sort of my home country, Argentina, talking to people there. It's very hard to make a living just being a professor. So people do consulting on the side. It takes time, which starts to take time away from your research. So having a PhD in a country, even with a high degree of education like Argentina, puts you in a very strong position that you manage certain knowledges. So you can make money and sort of to supplement your salary as a professor, people do that. So it's hard to be sort of what we do here in the United States, to be a full-time researcher. You do your teaching and basically you work with graduate students and you're doing research full-time. So the economic situation of universities isn't as good as in Europe or the United States. And I think that basically dampens the level of productivity. So you have the raw talent, people are getting their PhDs, great universities, sort of the working conditions sort of aren't as good. But I see, I mean, sort of there's a broad group, sort of a large group of people sort of with research skills, that are extremely sharp, thinking about the problems of their country, engaging in debates outside. So I read their works. I sort of converse with the people. I think sort of there's a lot there.
And what about in the U.S.? Like, so the attention of the profession here. I guess I'm thinking more than anything on political science regarding Latin America. Do you think that it's growing, or because I have the impression that a few decades ago Latin America was much more important in the public discussion in the U.S. and the interest for the region has vanished a bit. Even at Stanford, we only have a handful of people experts in Latin America, although it's just here next door, right? So what do you think about that?
I'd say that maybe there's a decline of political interest. So people complain the U.S. doesn't pay enough attention what it should pay to Latin America, only pays attention when there are problems. Okay, waves of migration coming from Central America. Yeah, sort of whatever, when we had sort of Chavez or Maduro, sort of those kind of things, rather than broader issues, sort of day-to-day issues. I think in terms of academia, I still see a lot of interest. I did some research, others have done that, looking publications. This is sort of in my field, sort of like in political science. You have more works on Latin America than on whatever, South Asia. So the proximity, in some sense, the ease of the language, sort of Spanish is relatively easy to pick up as a second language. I think lots of people in the U.S. academia study Latin America because you're starting to have, we've had democracy, sort of, you know, three decades, four decades. You start to have basic institutions and data that are similar to what have been used in the study of the United States. People are doing surveys. And so in some sense, sort of Latin America is sort of a very good laboratory, if you want, to test ideas. And so some people would even say sort of within political science, Latin America is overrepresented in terms of, if you look at publications in top journals. So I don't see that as a problem or sort of that. And I see it sort of, I'm not sure sort of just the trends over time, but sort of pretty constant over time. So there's a strong group of people within the disciplines that have expertise in Latin America that are engaging in disciplinary debates using their knowledge about Latin American countries. So I'm pretty optimistic in terms of that. But I mean, sort of, you at Stanford, you have Beatriz Magaloni, who's a very distinguished professor. It's sort of, so it's like,
Yeah, and I'm glad to hear that you're optimistic about that. I guess that sometimes we are just seeing the glass half empty, but. That's very good. I want to ask you more about Latin America in a bit, but I would like to focus for a while on your book because it's been a couple of weeks reading it and I found it pretty interesting. It is not about Latin America. It is about critical junctures, and probably we could start from there. Why don't you tell us what a critical juncture is and how has it become a sort of approach, you could argue, in the social sciences?
Yeah, so as introduction to the book lays out, the study of critical junctures is part of a broader trend within the social sciences to do more historical analysis. So we can look at what are the causes of the current situation by looking at what happened 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago. Okay, sort of you look at immediate or sort of pretty proximate causes. And I think sort of people are studying history, part because sort of there's just rich data, so there's interesting variation, and we're interested in trends over time. Sort of in economics, people talk about the great divergence, sort of this is in terms of economic, long-term process of economic development. What the critical juncture literature does that fits within sort of this broader sort of interest in historical analysis is that there are certain critical junctures, turning points. So I'll elaborate this a bit more. So those sudden shifts that have long-term consequences, okay? So there's some period, sort of you can say a critical juncture, the different ways you can sort of specified, it's a rapid change, it's a discontinuous change, so there's something really new that is introduced. A term that we use in the book is a qualitative break. So there's some big break, sort of you can think about sort of, you know, the beginning of industrialization, colonial sort of, the colonization of countries, the French Revolution, okay, big sudden changes. So there's a certain kind of change that's the focus of attention. And then the idea being that that is a cause of something sort of that endures for quite a long time. Within economics, there's a lot of focus on persistence. It's essentially the same idea sort of in the critical junctures. We talk about historical legacies. So there's a big change that has a long-term impact, things that are seen to endure for decades, maybe even centuries. So it's critical juncture research combines two research, a certain kind of change, and that happens sort of in the past that then creates this long-term persistent effect. So this is important if we're trying to understand, how do we think about the problems these days, different countries? What should we do? So you can think about different variables that are the proximate things, maybe, well, change your institutions, change the policies, and sort of that's sort of all fine and that's useful. But sometimes it's important to sort of think with more historical depth that some of the causes may be distant. These, in some sense, they may be more structural, harder to change. And sort of, if you're going to really analyze sort of the challenges and then think about sort of prescriptions, it's important to have that perspective in mind.
When I was reading the book, I was trying to think about what I would define as a critical juncture, in the sense of, okay, I kind of understand the concept. What type of events I would describe as a critical juncture or not? And I was trying to go through my limited knowledge of global history, trying to pin down like those events. And one of the elements that I probably struggled with was think about the right time frame to think about this, right? So you were talking about the Industrial Revolution or so on, the industrialization of the world. And then I was thinking, what should be considered here the critical juncture, right? Like the very granular event as the invention of the engine or so on, or like broader forces that you could still argue that are part of this, right? So when I was thinking about this, probably every important event has this series of micro events that ended up leading to the emergence of this, right? So if we think about, I don't know, World War II or whatever, one can always think about the meeting or the call that two global leaders had at some point. And also if you zoom out, you can talk about larger forces that could have played out over decades, if not centuries, if one is having a very long durée type of framework. So what's your take around that? How do you think that the literature deals with that? Is there a nuance that it's not worth paying too much attention to? What's your take on that?
So the idea of critical juncture is an abstract, very generic concept. Then if we're doing some kind of research project and I want to sort of know why certain countries are wealthy and others aren't, yeah, I want to know why some are democratic, others are not, sort of think of whatever the question, the outcome that you're interested in. Then this is sort of the theorizing. Yeah, sort of it's like, what is sort of the long-term causes of these things? Of these events, and this is where you have a debate. So you can say sort of, I think the causes are historical. Okay, sort of, and maybe we all agree we need to look historically. Then the question is, how far back do we go? Yes, some people say, well, let's look three decades ago. Whatever, there's a big change, sort of neoliberalism. Yes, sort of, we talk about that in Latin America and some other countries. There's a big economic restructuring. I think, to understand the present, we need to sort of look at what changed in the 1980s into the 1990s. Others say, no, you need to go further back. Yeah, sort of, okay, when you had sort of the transition to mass politics, incorporation of workers, this is fundamental to the work of David and Ruth Collier, shaping the political arena. Others say, no, we need to go further back when states were formed. In the 19th century, this is in this volume that we're discussing, Sebastian Mazuka makes an argument that that's what you need to sort of focus on to understand the diverse sort of economic fortunes of countries. Others, then we have sort of the very well-known Acemoglu and Robinson, various others sort of, no, it's colonialism. There was some colonial period, so that's taking us further back, yeah, sort of. So in some cases, the age of discovery, sort of, you know, 1500. I mean, that's where countries went off on different paths. So you can have sort of a debate, who is right? So that's one way to take it as competing hypothesis. So that's very interesting. Yeah, sort of it's like which is sort of the most important turning point, sort of. Okay, sort of. So that's one way to think. We think in terms of variables. Which one is more important? Maybe everyone contributed, but one was more important. Those are things then we can test. Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting. We can think. Some people say it's like if I'm right, you're wrong. So it's totally competing hypothesis. We can think maybe a supplementary. They're all sort of contributing something. So that's where you start to get into interesting debates. Yeah, sort of. We agree that we want to explain some outcome. Which are the historical roots, origins of some divergence that we're interested in? The literature, I don't think, has reached that point. There's some debates. Yeah, sort of. I think, you know, this was a more important critical juncture than the other. Usually when we see the testing and sort of, so we have lots sort of in terms of quantitative testing, it's basically, I say, this is a critical juncture versus, you know, it doesn't matter. Yeah, sort of. So we haven't gotten in the empiric sort of to that that level, which I think is sort of, that's something that's opened up once you start doing this kind of research. We have some cases, the one that I found that goes the furthest back is Jared Diamond. Yeah, sort of. So we have to go back to whatever. It's basically the Neolithic revolution, sort of 10,000 more years ago. So this is a debate, you know, sort of, if I start doing historical research, do I have to cover everything over the last 10,000 years? It's like, you know, don't tell me that. I don't want to do this research. Then it's impossible. Yeah, sort of. So then these are sometimes sort of theoretical choices or sort of practical choices. Okay, I'm going to focus on the impact of some event, whatever, the Great Depression. Okay, what impact has the Great Depression had? Yeah, sort of, and sort of the lingering impact it has. So those are the kind of debates that we have that it's similar to the rest of the science. You know, sort of, I think it's sort of this factor or that factor. Historical research can be theorized in the same way and then sort of tested in the same way.
Let me ask you about like the methodological approach there. And when you were describing like the empirical challenges of the field, you mentioned, well, the quantitative challenges there. But in the book, you describe this agenda is one that has been traditionally dominated by qualitative research, and in recent years, quantitative approaches have become important, right? I'm probably most familiar with the quantitative side of that and the literature on persistence, but I would like to know then what has been the reception of that sub-agenda and the broader conversation on critical junctures. Is people broadly happy with the conventional persistence paper? Do they think that this quantitative approach is really adding something or not? What's the vibe of the community around this conversation?
So I'd say in sociology, political science, starting in the 60s, 70s, research that was linked with, people talk about the broader field of comparative historical analysis, the critical juncture, largely qualitative, case-based. Barrington Moore is sort of a very sort of prominent work on the origins of dictatorship and democracy that sort of carried out qualitative research. The book by David Collier and Ruth Collier, Shaping the Political Arena, 1991, basically takes 8 countries in Latin America, very sort of rigorous comparative qualitative analysis. We start to see sort of, this is sort of in economics with Cleometrics, with North, others in the 1960s, people saying, well, this is good, let's collect data, let's have quantitative data, let's analyze it, yes. That started, people did some interesting studies. the paper, and this is, I mean, that's really sort of influenced sort of all fields, sort of the Acemoglu, Johnson and Robinson 2001 paper on the impact of colonialism on economic development. So that was sort of one of the first papers that said, hey, look, you can study these arguments quantitatively. A lot of debate whether the instrument was the right one, but it's like that paper became a model. I think that's sort of what started a lot of then the quantitative studies about long-term impacts. They use the concept of critical juncture, and Jim Robinson contributes a paper to our volume. Others are using just persistence and not critical junctures. I think there's some differences, but broadly similar. I think the quantitative literature has taken off. It's becoming more and more important. It started with economics, but more and more political scientists are doing it. We have sort of, in some sense, a new label sort of that people are using, historical political economy. There's a new volume coming out, an edited volume by Oxford. It's largely political scientists, some economists, but that essentially sort of like, how can we study these issues quantitatively? So I think this is becoming more and more of an active agenda. I think people are reading it. I think they're finding it useful. It's very intensive in terms of collecting data, sort of to have historical data. So there's some issues about the quality of the data. So I think there's starting to be a dialogue between, look, we've been doing qualitative research, and people continue to do that. But now we have a new literature. Are we talking the same language? Do these things combine? How might they combine? So one of the things that sort of in this volume with Collier we talk about, sort of this is one of the new questions, sort of how can we sort of combine, integrate the more quantitative and the more qualitative research? I would just say sort of one thing. First that I think thinking about having both and how to combine them is the way to think about it. Some people think that sort of with the quantitative, it supersedes, it takes everything that the qualitative has and does it better. I think there's still advantages that the quantitative and the qualitative have. The studies, so I wrote a chapter sort of basically looking at the quantitative studies. They basically carry out a regression, okay, that there's some distant event and you try and sort of connect it with sort of some very later event. The paper by Dell on Peru is just fantastic. It's just like wonderful sort of, and shows actually the knowledge of the case sort of to be able sort of to make some methodological choices. Even that one, which is actually has more data sort of, looks at persistence over like 3 points in time, sort of. But so usually there's some very distant effects, maybe some of the best papers on colonialism, okay, the differences in colonialism across countries, sort of within countries in India, how does that impact current situations? So you have like a big gap, sometimes a century, more than a century, sort of, with very little data in between. And so I think that's great, sort of that anchors you, sort of if you can find sort of your findings sort of that fit your argument. But sort of the qualitative researcher would say, great, I love that, sort of. But if you're making an argument that sort of some historical event had a long-term impact, that historical event has ceased to recur. So, I mean, that's not changing, okay? The French Revolution happened, it ended. Colonialism happened, it ended. So you want to tell me, I mean, the big challenge is like, how does that persist over time? So here we have various terms, sort of mechanisms of reproduction, mechanisms of transmission. The idea of path dependence is very crucial in terms of anchoring that idea. So what qualitative studies do is say sort of, does this change that happened. And these are the mechanisms of reproduction. I need to study them over time, not just maybe at the end point or sort of, you know, at two points in time. So I want to see if those mechanisms of reproduction, and you can think of this sort of as a causal argument, are happening over 50 years, for example. Sort of in some sense to connect, yeah, the historical event to the more current outcome. So I think there's a difference there in terms of having data over more points in time, that I haven't seen that yet in the quantitative studies. I think that could be done to make more plausible the argument that sort of this historical event, you know, is connected to this particular outcome. So I think that's an area where I think there's a lot of supplementarity. I could make another point about how people think about mechanisms. I think that's an interesting area for discussion as well.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I would like to hear about that because I have the impression that at least in economics in the last couple of years or so, there has been probably even a strong pushback towards the persistence literature. Some of it comes precisely from what you're pointing out, which is that a good part of these papers seem to be uninterested or incapable of talking about mechanisms. But probably there is a broader sense that at an aggregate level, we're struggling to extract very robust lessons in the sense that pretty much every type of exogenous shock, or as we prefer to frame in this quantitative persistence literature, has been explored. And now we have evidence that pretty much everything could have like a persistent effect in the very long term. And then that opens the question to, well, if everything might matter, then probably nothing really matters, right? And I guess that all these things are building up, and that has increased the skepticism towards this type of papers recently, which I somewhat share to some point. At the same time, I really think that there are great papers and great insights from this literature. But it seems to me that you have the impression that maybe this qualitative literature could deal with some of those problems, right? And the study of mechanism seems to be one of those avenues. Is that a bit how you're seeing the future of the field?
So let me make a theoretical and then sort of more methodological point. I haven't read sort of the pushback that you're suggesting. I can see that people have some problems with the persistence literature. One line of critique, and so this is the theoretical point, is that people say, well, this happened colonialism, and then there's path dependence. And whatever, you wave your hands, path dependence, that's why, you know, you have the situation. You got into a problem, You couldn't get out of it. You had sort of some good sort of, you know, institutions. Take that's the Morgan Robinson stuff on sort of economic development. And that's going to sort of, once you have sort of the right set of institutions, political, economic, that's going to be reproduced over time. And you kind of wave your hand sort of. So people have said that what we have is a sense of path-dependent determinism. So it's kind of whatever it's like. If you're thinking about sort of you're in a problematic situation, it's fatalistic. Well, so you had colonialism, and you know, whatever, maybe the wrong kind of colonialism, and left some negative institutions. You're stuck with that. So people are saying, well, no. There could be change. There could be another critical juncture. So you can't just say sort of, okay, this happened and then things persist. So there's, I think, a very interesting literature. This has to do with the issue of agency and choice. That in terms of the persistence, at every point in time, there are going to be some actors that would like to break with that equilibrium. Let me use that term. Yeah, sort of. They would like to break. They would be better off with a different situation. So to say that it persists, you need to actually say that sort of despite sort of, you know, efforts to break from an equilibrium, it persists. And obviously, I mean, sort of, you know, you have critical junctures. You can have in the past, you can have a new critical juncture. So you're not fated sort of to just see whatever outcome persists forever. The quantitative studies, I don't think, deal with that issue, but sort of in some of the broader theoretical debates, people are thinking about that. I think there's a very interesting discussion. It links a bit with what you said. Critical junctures are big, sudden changes, and people say, well, those happen every now and then. What happens much more frequently is small incremental changes. So, yeah, maybe you're not going to see a change in the structure of the global economy, okay? But you're going to see sort of some small incremental changes. Those over time then may add up to something bigger or may trigger a critical juncture, a discontinuous change. So people are saying maybe this literature sort of has a very narrow understanding of change. It only looks at big changes. When there are small changes happening the whole time. So I think one sort of challenge is how we connect the thinking about these big changes and sort of rare and sort of the much more common, incremental, gradual kind of changes. So I think that's sort of an important way to think about things. And sort of, yeah, well, we can't change the entire structure of the economy, whatever, that's maybe responsible for sort of poverty in Latin America, but you can make some small changes, okay? So you break with sort of the fatalistic view, sort of that things can't be changed. So I think that's sort of more sort of how we theorize about change and its impact. And sort of there's a very interesting discussion, new literature, a lot in political science about incremental change, different forms of incremental change. So I think there should be a dialogue between those two literatures. The more methodological issue, and sort of this is how I react when I read sort of a lot of the quantitative literature, they do talk about mechanisms. Yeah, so I find that people, that's part of the language. So you have some initial change. You try and, you know, see if it's exogenous. You have an eventual outcome. And sort of there's something in the middle, yeah, sort of. So people say, okay, there's this change that led to this outcome because it changed certain things in the middle. And sort of people talk about those as causal mechanisms. The causal mechanisms, that is sort of just straight intervening variables which spell out the argument. So it enriches the argument. Sometimes there's tests of those. Usually those tests are just like pretty simple regressions. Yeah, sort of they don't. So I haven't seen sort of things that really convince you sort of that it has a secondary role. Yeah, sort of it's sort of interesting theoretically when you look at the empirics. It's like, well, you don't obviously think it's that important because it's something that came at the end and you didn't really work it through as much. I think the qualitative literature spends more time specifying the mechanisms, but then studying them over time. Yeah, so this is, I mean, you can do historical sort of qualitative research, and we have a term that we use, process tracing. Yeah, sort of. So I'm going to see sort of in year one what happened, in year two, in year three, in year four. Is some process that I sort of, you know, theorize as a mechanism actually sort of occurring as I basically say it is. So that can actually sort of connect sort of, you know, sort of like the beginning and the end point better than the quantitative literature does. If you take sort of, this is the Shaping the Political Arena by David and Ruth Collier. It's an 800-page book with 8 cases, and they sort of, so they're looking at the impact of the changes in the 30s for outcomes in the 70s. And they, I mean, they, this is dense historical research, analytical, that links the changes in the 30s with eventual outcomes. Yeah, sort of coups or persistence of regimes is their outcome. So I see more richer sort of fleshed out arguments with empirics in the qualitative literature than in the quantitative literature. So I think this is where there's actually quite a bit of complementarity, I think. And I think it answers some of the questions that people may have. One just final point in terms of the mechanisms, I think sort of, so in terms of the mechanisms, so I think this literature sort of has latched on to this idea of path dependence that comes from economists, David Arthur, North then sort of linked it sort of with institutional analysis. The arguments tend to be biased. Okay, because of this, some outcome is always going to be favored. That they're not putting enough sort of, you know, emphasis on mechanisms that lead to destabilization. So there are mechanisms that explain why things are stable. So we have like the QWERTY example, sort of a classic example. You have a typewriter and stuff like that, even though you have one that's more efficient because people have sunk costs and all this kind of stuff. They have the habit, they're going to continue using sort of the QWERTY keyboard, even if that's not the most efficient. But it seems like all of the arguments is like, I'm going to try and give you as much evidence about why things should continue. And not thinking about sort of possible sort of alternatives that would destabilize, that would seek change. So when people talk about mechanisms of reproduction, that they're always sort of focusing on what would help reproduction, why things would persist. Yeah, sort of. And then it's like, oh, things change, big surprise. Yeah, sort of. Rather than theorizing, well, no, there's always struggle. Yeah, sort of. There's always change happening. So to think more sort of clearly about sort of, this isn't the conflict between mechanisms that lead to persistence and stability, but sort of to think the possibility of change even within a sort of a pretty persistent structure.
There's something that I love about your answer on this question and, well, in general about our conversation in the book itself, which is this interdisciplinary approach and like you provide a view of how different disciplines might have some interesting insight to the broad conversation. And I think that's, I guess, a perspective that we should foster and cultivate more. And I love that about the book. And I have actually a question about that in like from a practical point of view and this role that you and David had as editors of bringing together people from different fields and different like professional trajectories. How did you manage to make it work? How's the role of being an editor of a volume that it's fairly large with so many people involved that is expected to provide a broad view of a complex topic, but still being coherent, having a kind of narrative arc overall? How did you manage that? How did you contact the people? How did you manage to make them fit the schedule? Tell me a bit about that.
So it was a long process. So we started with an initial meeting, a professional meeting of the American Political Science Association in 16. So it was like, and there wasn't an idea of a volume at that point in time. So it's like, the process was like 6 years, the entire process. We had this conference to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the publication of David Collier's Shaping the Political Arena. So that was just like an open conversation. We had a panel, yeah, sort of. And then we said, oh, like maybe we can do something with it. So we started to work and get people interested to write short papers. And then eventually the idea of a volume emerged. In terms of recruiting people, it's like, I mean, it's networks, yeah. So this is where networks are. And these are things that are accumulated over a long period of time. The contributors are mainly people that David Collier knew, some that I knew. Just, I'll give you an example, sort of James Robinson. Yeah, sort of, he had actually been teaching in economics at the University where I am at USC, and he was recruited by political science at Berkeley. So they actually had a joint seminar. I was visiting in 2000, so I actually sat in one of these seminars in which they were reading books on critical junctures. So David Collier, Ruth Collier, and Jim Robinson was there. So they knew each other. Then he moved on to Harvard, now Chicago. So it's like people that you know. There are lots sort of, the main group is sort of Latin Americanists, or some sociologists, Robert Fishman. These are people sort of that you've known professionally over different points in time. With Fishman, so he had just published a book on transition to democracy in the Iberian Peninsula, a comparison of Portugal and Spain. And he wasn't using the critical juncture framework explicitly, but he had similar ideas. So we said, it's like, oh, it's like, your book is like great, you know, sort of, it seems like you're saying sort of what we're trying to do without explicitly using the concept. Like, see if maybe you can reformulate sort of your work more explicitly in terms of this conceptual framework. Yeah, sort of. So that went back and forth sort of a lot of time, sort of refining things. We had panels at three consecutive conferences of the American Political Science Association. So with different papers, sort of we basically debated them, gave feedback over 3 years. And then, I mean, sort of, this is just the hard thing in terms of edited volume, sort of, can you have some level of consistency and similar use of, not, I mean, concepts you can't regulate, but sort of more or less sort of that clearly sort of that they're tied together. And this is working back and forth a lot. Sort of, this is, we do this sort of, you know, sometimes through Zoom, emails. It takes sort of a lot of time sort of to do that. And it's like the author sending us a paper, David and I sort of would go through it, give comments, you know, sort of extensive comments. So it's a pretty laborious process. I think that helps sort of, it's more doable if you know the people ahead of time. If you have sort of lots of people for a volume, and sort of like some of these Oxford handbooks that are gigantic, yeah, sort of, it's hard sort of for you to know everybody, sort of. So it's hard, and I mean, you can't sort of push somebody sort of, if you don't know them well, it's like, well, I think you could do this a bit better, you know, here's a suggestion, yeah, sort of, well, they can say yes, no, whatever. But that has to do sort of with the sense of community that you're building. You do that sort of by having these meetings. At one of the meetings that we had in Washington, D.C., this was American Political Science Association. So the day before, we had a working dinner. So that's sort of, again, when we meet at these conferences, bring your sort of, you know, your collaborators together and sort of have people sort of discuss papers. you discuss it, then you have dinner, sort of. So there's a social aspect to it, but sort of having frequent interactions. A lot of this happened during the pandemic, so the idea of having a face-to-face conference day and a half, which would have, that's I think the thing to do always. We couldn't do that, so we had some Zoom interactions, but not the standard conference. So that's a bit the story of
that's very interesting. I'm not sure that people are aware like how much effort is behind some of the collective endeavors in academia, right? Which are pretty much built in what you described, right? Like a subtle social interaction setting, you know? It's not like you could put everyone in a studio for a month and come up with a book, but it's a long process. But the outcome is great. I really love the book. And I think they're like great lessons for not only for people thinking about critical junctures and persistence, but whoever is interested in history as an important force behind societal outcomes. So I'm very glad that you decided to put the effort to bring together all the people and come up with this volume. I would like to talk to you about something else before finishing, and it's about Latin America, taking advantage of the opportunity that you're an expert on the region. I would like to hear your perception about the current juncture. How do you see the region from a political point of view? We have recently moved to what seems a new pink tide or so. My take on this was that it was a reaction from some exhaustion of the political alternatives that had dominated after a couple of decades and the protests that we saw in Chile, in Colombia a couple of years ago probably were a sign of that. However, I'm being recently puzzled by the protests in Peru. The Peruvian case seems to be probably not fitting very well that broad trend. So I don't know, how do you think about that? Which countries do you think we should be paying more attention to? I don't know, what's your broad approach to the situation?
Yeah, so I mean, the picture is very diverse. Some people give a very negative read of sort of the current situation. I think there are problems, but they've actually been around, or the problems sort of take different forms. Yeah, sort of. If you go back to the 1990s, we had very weak governments that were falling. Yeah, sort of. So we had one point in time that half of the governments were not the elected ones. Yeah, sort of. There'd been an election, but that government collapsed. Yeah, sort of. This is when they were implementing free market reforms. So the government would collapse in the face of protests. Yeah, sort of. So we had like two weak governments. Then we had like two strong governments. And sort of you think about Venezuela with Hugo Chavez, Correa in Ecuador. So like Correa in Ecuador, you had like three elected presidents that can't end their term. So they're too weak, yeah, sort of. And then you go to one that's maybe too strong, yeah, sort of. You go from one side to another. So the different problems, I don't know which one's worse. So I see different kind of problems over time. Not necessarily that things are getting worse. There's some countries definitely sort of, you know, things have gotten worse. But I'd say sort of an overall positive. Then I'll sort of add something a bit more than problematic. You had transitions to democracy in the 80s, 90s. Most of those regimes have endured. So never before have you had 30, 40 years of elections, competitive elections, alternation in power. So this is the first time in Latin America that this seems to be an equilibrium, a norm. Yeah, sort of. It's not high level, maybe sort of as we'd like, sort of high quality democracies, how we talk about this. But it's enduring, which wasn't the case ever before in the history of Latin America. So that's the positive. There's clearly a negative, and we're seeing this in protests, that there's a disconnect between the political leaders and society. We see this with the protests. We saw this in Colombia. We saw it in Ecuador. This is going back to 1819, the big protests starting in October of 19 in Chile. So there's a disconnect with the establishment, yeah, if you want, sort of. So you elect people, but they seem to be sort of very distant. In some countries, sort of in Argentina, they talk about a political caste. Yeah, so it's like, you know, very different, distant from the citizens. So people talk about a crisis of representation. And sort of you have these protests, and sometimes you have repression. You have sort of a lot of repression in the case of, again, sort of Ecuador, Colombia. We're seeing it sort of, there are other things to it in Peru right these days. So you have repression, yeah, which then adds to the problem. So we're not having politicians that are legitimate, that are seen as representing citizens. So there are clearly problems with how democracy is working. Sometimes then you have sort of such frustrations that it leads to populist reactions. So, and I think that sort of put negative, sort of if you take Bolsonaro, the things that he was doing in Brazil, take the case of El Salvador with Bukele. People are desperate for a solution to the problem of violence. Sort of, he's basically using pretty autocratic methods to do it, but he's generating results. He's like the most popular president in Latin America. So he's got about 60-80% approval. Boric, who was sort of like, you know, seen as a new person, sort of like new face of leadership in Chile, has about like 20-25% approval. So it's like he's much more democratic in terms of his way of doing things. But it's not working politically in terms of, like, you know, being whatever, gaining support of the population. So this is sort of the problem we're having, sort of economic, but then sort of issues having to do with security. Does the government respond to what citizens want? So we're seeing all sorts of problematic features. The attempt at a coup, short-lived sort of Peru with Castillo, and then this leading to this new government that sort of is creating sort of all sorts of problems. I'd say sort of, I mean, again, sort of that's all negative. So the positive, so let me sort of end them with a positive sort of. So what is the solution in Peru? Move elections forward fast. Yeah, sort of. So the way out is elections. People aren't saying, let's go back to military governments or sort of annul elections. Sort of people say elections, sort of you have to reconnect sort of, you know, with citizens approving, giving consent to who's governing. You also have sort of change. Yeah, sort of Lula was elected in Brazil, even though they're seeing the problems that we're seeing there. After the period of Bolsonaro, sort of, okay, first you had, I think this is very important, the opposition unified. Lula and Fernando Cardoso had been competitors. They were like sort of two key leaders. And Cardoso basically said, sort of, given the alternative, Bolsonaro, I support Lula. So you have oppositions that basically say the threat of some of these leaders is so big, let's set some of our differences aside, political, sort of personal, it could be. Let's unify, and sort of that's a big part of sort of then why Lula won. One part of why Lula won the election. So problems are being solved in the case of Brazil through elections. Yeah, sort of. I think the election of Lula, I see it in positive terms, needing alternation, and sort of. I think the things that Lula liked you to do about issues with sort of some of the policies, you know, that he implemented in the past, sort of issues of corruption. I think that's a big problem. But so I wouldn't say sort of, and sort of I'd push back. Latin America has entered into a downward spiral, and sort of it's like a lot of noise. It gets better, it gets worse. I think in some cases, the political leadership is learning some lessons. I think an active civil society protesting is very good, very healthy. That's an important check on leaders. So I'd give you sort of a mixed assessment, which shows, to be attentive. You ask sort of any particular country to follow. Some cases, just are very negative, and Venezuela, Nicaragua, obviously you put Cuba in terms of being non-democratic. The two big countries is obviously Mexico and Brazil to look at. What happens in them is very important. So you've had the election of Lula, and now we're going to see what happens there. Mexico, there's the issue of does the government of López Obrador curtail some of the autonomy of key institutions like the electoral authorities, the INE? I see that as worrying. Recently, there was a pretty scandalous incident over the appointment of the head of the Supreme Court, with one of the candidates very close to the government being involved in a plagiarism scandal. But the person that was eventually elected is somebody pretty independent of the government. So those are things that I pay attention to.
That's great. I feel we should have another conversation just to talk about Latin America. I'm very glad we had the opportunity to bring together all these topics, which was fascinating in many ways. I've noticed that you're a good a Twitter user, and you share great advice on books and stuff. How can people find you on Twitter?
If you put my name, Gerardo Monk, my Twitter handle is @GerardoMonk. I only joined recently in August of last year. I got exposed to what Twitter is. It's kind of a crazy place, but tried to have then more of an academic discussion. So I talk about books in different fields. Sometimes I read a lot. If you're interested in this topic, these are 6 books that I think are useful. Sometimes some political commentary, but not accusatory I had a table, after the incidents in Brazil, people said the problems of democracy always come from the right, like Bolsonaro. People say, well, here's a table of various crises from 1990 on. It comes from both sides. I don't know. So that's using stuff that is part of my research to share I'll share information about documentaries, other kind of things. At Gerardo Monk, you'll find me there.
That's great. Yeah, I think you contribute to make Twitter a less dirty place, which I think, if you use it wisely, I think actually it's a great source of information and even entertainment. I'm actually also very active on Twitter. People can find me as Javier Mejia. Let me thank you again. This was a lovely conversation, Gary. I hope to talk to you soon.
Great talking to you, Javier. I enjoyed this a lot. Thanks a lot, and keep up your good work.